Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Michael J. Murphy, who writes for the UK Daily Telegraph and Canada's National Post. In the last couple of years, he has covered extensively the problems in Ireland in relation to mass immigration and the growing political backlash there. In this episode, we discuss the scale of the problem in Ireland and some of its unique characteristics, why the progressive culture of the Irish political establishment has openly encouraged mass immigration and ignored the lessons from other European countries, whether Conor McGregor and other nationalistic figures or parties are likely to emerge to bring change. And towards the end, we also discuss some of the current issues in the UK, including the recent refusal of the British Home Office to grant a visa to French intellectual Renaud Camus, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Michael Murphy of UK Daily Telegraph, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Yeah, great. I've been interested to talk to you because I've been following your coverage of, various subjects, but Irish immigration issues most recently. How did you end up getting involved on that beat?
Well, I think, like a lot of people, it first came onto my radar really in late 2023 when there were spectacular scenes of violence erupting on the streets of Dublin. It was the worst riot in modern times in Ireland, where it was precipitated by a naturalized Algerian migrant in Ireland, who had went on a stabbing spree, stabbing three young children and their minder. And this then, spread like wildfire on social media. People came out and looted stores. It has to be said, a lot of it was just opportunistic thuggery. It's interesting to note that the bookstore on O'Connell Street wasn't raided, but the shoe stores were. So that was really the first time that I started taking an interest in the Irish situation. I'm actually Irish myself. Mm. Both parents came over from Ireland to the UK, hence my plummy English accent. And I started watching the debate in Ireland because there were some similarities, I thought, with how the immigration the predicament of mass migration was dealt with in the UK over the last 50 years, which I've studied very closely, and where Ireland was at. It seemed like they were discussing this issue in a way that was, reminded me of Britain in the 90s or early 2000s. It seemed like they were just a few decades behind us in terms of what was acceptable to say and wasn't.
What do you think is unique about Ireland's situation, and what is similar to what's going on in the UK and indeed the rest of the Western world when it comes to the problems involved with mass immigration?
Well, Ireland's unique for several reasons. First, being that it's a relatively recent phenomenon in Ireland, whereas it's been going on a sort of low simmer in most European countries since the end of World War II. Ireland really retained its cultural and ethnic homogeneity until, well into the 2000s, when several Eastern European countries acceded into the European Union. They had a large influx of Poles and Lithuanians, people with some cultural proximity to what was then a still fairly Catholic Ireland. And, on the whole, they came to work, they assimilated fairly well. It wasn't without its problems, but it was nothing like the integration issues that we've seen throughout Europe with migrants predominantly from Africa and Asia. And so they started off pretty late. They then started ramping up the number of asylum seekers that they were taking, which has ballooned by almost 700% in the last decade. These are predominantly people from some of the most dysfunctional regions on earth, including Somalia and Afghanistan and Algeria. And so it seemed to me that, you know, Ireland very much prides itself on being a proud member of the European community. It sees mm-hmm. itself as a federal outpost of that project. And it seemed to me, or at least the Irish liberal elites who ruled the country. And it seemed to me that they had ignored some of the signal lessons that the European Union had to offer on dabbling in that kind of mass migration. So I thought that was interesting, that it seemed like they were, in a way, the sort of last car in a pile-up crash, just feeding along full pelt into a set of very predictable quagmires and problems.
Is it correct to say that illegal immigration, that is, people coming across by boat, isn't really an issue in Ireland like it is in the UK and had been in Australia and at least is a big problem in the United States with people crossing the border? Like, is that aspect of it they don't have to deal with to the same degree, right?
They don't have people arriving by boats like we do in Dover mm-hmm. and elsewhere. They do have illegal migration just via other routes. So, for example, in recent years, many people have arrived into Dublin airports having destroyed their travel documents en route. Now, if you or I were to do that, Dan, we would be arrested and detained. But it seemed like the law didn't really apply to newcomers if they were claiming refugee status. And so that law wasn't enforced, and a lot of people were allowed to remain in the country, and, you know, very hard to keep track of them once they're in. On that basis, there's also, by the government's own admission now, more than 80% of migrants are estimated to come from the border with Northern Ireland, which at Dublin's insistence during Brexit negotiations is a borderless border. There's no infrastructure to vet anybody or impose checks on where they're coming from and whether they have a right to be in the country. And so the borders have been extremely porous in recent years, and that's allowed for a lot of what we now know conclusively to be illegal migration. The government recently admitted that around 80% of the people now arriving are in fact economic migrants posing as refugees.
Right. So I'm just trying to get a sense of the mechanics of it. If I'm, say, like a Syrian refugee or someone from North Africa, and I make it to Europe, why do I go to Dublin Airport rather than jump on a boat across the English Channel to get to England directly? Why take that route rather than the other one?
So I think, you know, once you have an established pattern of migration, what we call chain migration in this country, you might have a similar concept, is that a lot of this stuff is word of mouth. You have a settled community who will arrive and say, okay, I was treated in this way. This is how you can perhaps game the system. And Ireland, unlike Britain in recent years, has been just hook, line and sinker in favor of, giving the world's refugees fabulous inducements in the form of, you know, one minister comes to mind, Roderick O'Gorman, who was the Minister of Integration in Ireland. He sent out a tweet in 2021 in 8 languages, including Urdu, Somali, Arabic, basically advertising Ireland to the world, in the manner of an estate agent. He was offering people own door accommodation and, various welfare benefits that weren't even on offer to Irish citizens were given. And so I would imagine that had some impact. I think that, you know, the UK, when they were talking about a repatriation scheme using Rwanda as a sort of return hub for migrants or a third country, that I think that slightly made Britain a less appealing destination, and perhaps people were probing Ireland to see if that was a softer touch. I know from my own experiences speaking with refugees and economic migrants in Ireland that they were that there was virtually no friction in them coming into the country and often gaining citizenship, and that was a big draw.
Right. And immigration is always about the numbers. How many are we talking, and where predominantly do these people come from?
So there's broadly speaking, three buckets of migrants coming into Ireland. There is the economic migration that's done, on the books, and that's been a large share of the migration that, say, for example, in 2023, the country's population grew by 3.5%, which is, a broke records in the European Union. I think there's only a handful of examples since the European Union was founded that have grown at that scale. And a large part of that has been economic migration from places like India and Nigeria. Then there was a large influx of Ukrainian asylum seekers after the war there got going, where Ireland took around 100,000, which, relatively speaking, I think was second only to Poland in the European Union. And then lastly, there are asylum seekers, which are considered separate from the Ukrainians. And, that has gone up by 650% over the last decade. And those are people predominantly from, some of the most dysfunctional parts of Africa and Asia, including, Pakistan, North Africa, and Nigeria is actually where a lot of them have been coming from in recent years. And so the state's capacity to accommodate all of these people pretty much collapsed at the end of last year. And so, they had to start handing out tents and sleeping bags. And I believe there's currently more than 3,000 homeless asylum seekers waiting on accommodation in Ireland.
So am I right to understand it's been driven more by refugees and economic migrant than mass migration, like in Australia, where people supposedly come here who are skilled migrants and the numbers go up that way? And is it different to what, because reading the UK press, there's all this talk about, the Boris wave, the people that Boris Johnson let in after Brexit, and people were claiming that, the places that people migrants came from different parts of the world other than Europe after Brexit. But it seems like in Ireland, the same thing happened even though they remained in the EU.
Yes, I think that the Boris wave was indicative of something that was far larger. Almost every European country saw a large rise in migration after COVID. There were immense stresses on parts of the developing world during COVID where, industries, people lost employment, people lost economic opportunities, and there was an explosion of people on the move once the world opened up again. And the Boris wave was just one of the largest cohorts, but Ireland experienced a very similar phenomenon of people from external to the EU coming to the country. And so it's very difficult to a lot of the time these things are quite overdetermined. You could say that what was it, the pull factors from Ireland, was it the push factors of just international migration in general? I think it was an interplay of the two that led to that wave of migration around Europe.
Yeah, what explains the particular political culture of Ireland, which sort of, at least from a distance, seems to want to outdo everyone else in terms of their openness and progressiveness to allowing refugees and migrants to come in from all corners of the world? It seems they're well beyond the attitude in Italy or other parts of Europe, right? Why do you think that is?
I think for several reasons. One is that they can afford to be more bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about migration than Italy because they haven't felt the negative effects of it for the last 60 years. I also think that this is what you're describing, this need to be the world's most moral actor in a given crisis or scenario is very symptomatic of certain kinds of small social democracies. We saw it in Sweden, for example, in the 1960s and 70s. They took to calling themselves a moral superpower. And it seems like they were getting drunk on their own propaganda, because they really followed through. There wasn't on that promise. There wasn't a crisis around the world that they didn't want the largest slice of the refugee action from. And now they're putting on all the brakes that they can. And I think Ireland is in a similar situation where they can't, you know, they don't have an army. They don't, well, they do, but they don't have a significant military force, or and so they feel like they need to punch above their weight in certain other ways.
Yeah, I mean, a bit like the Canadians with the Americans. You know, they have to differentiate themselves not through their hard power, but through their, you know, being nicer and more friendly than those, you know, bad guys down south. Is that sort of what's going on? They have to. They're not like, it just strikes me strange that that there seems to be a lack of awareness about how the problems that have existed with mass migration in other European countries weren't going to transpire in the same way in Ireland. Why couldn't they see that coming down the line?
When I've challenged Irish politicians on exactly this question that you're raising, Dan, you know, you often get a slightly milquetoast response about something the GAA, Gaelic football will help them to integrate. And it's a very feeble form of Irish exceptionalism, I think, where they just think, they'll come over, they'll have the crack, and we're welcoming people. What could go wrong? I dare say there's some naivety actually in the country. I don't think that many Irish people have experienced the ghettos in Malmo or Rotterdam or indeed in sort of the Midlands throughout England. I think if they'd been to Luton, which was named the terrorist capital of the world, I think by the CIA some decades ago, they would appreciate that they're actually in slightly deeper waters than they'd like to admit.
Yeah, it just seems like there has been a complete political transformation of that country. And as we were discussing offline just before, you know, there's traditionally Australia had about 40% of its population who could trace their ancestry to Ireland. And, you know, there were a lot of sympathies to that country over the last, century for, its dogged sort of claims for independence and maintaining itself as a separate people and with all the troubles and everything else that went with that. But it now seems as though their claim is not to be a separate people, but to be a multicultural society that doesn't have any almost distinctive ethnic component to it. Is that fair?
Yes, I think if we were to do a postmortem on the island that you're describing there, the island of wanting to retain the Gaelic language and having a skepticism of being drawn into large organizations, I think that there was a collapse of confidence on two fronts in Ireland in the late 90s and early 2000s. The first was the Catholic Church abuse scandals, which, really came to prominence in the late 90s, early 2000s. And that was, that saw essentially the moral lodestar of the society collapse completely. Then in, 2008, you had the Irish were among the worst impacted by the global financial crisis. And after that, there was a rush to sort of hand over the keys to a lot of the sovereign functions of the government, including, monetary policy, trade policy, over to the European Union and the European Central Bank. And so you had a twin crises of, are we able to manage our own affairs, and do we know what we're about ethically, morally? And I think into that vacuum came lots of American capital from multinationals, on which Ireland's economy now is completely dependent, because it's got a favorable tax environment. And with the American money, I think came American values. You saw an explosion of NGOs in Ireland. I think there's now 33,000 NGOs, more than there are policemen or nurses in Ireland. Mm. And these organizations are essentially often bankrolled by the government or various, who are in turn bankrolled by these American multinationals, who are there. Many of them do good work and are fairly uncontroversial, but many of them have an ideological axe to grind. They will be promoting, racial and sexual dogmas that have, became the norm in America in recent decades. And those really took hold in Ireland. That's why you've seen the country transform at breakneck speed in terms of its moral and governing outlook.
Well, yeah, you had, and I'm a lawyer and dealt with tech companies a bit. I mean, Ireland is it's like Silicon Valley. I read a stat or listened to a stat the other day. It said, which I haven't been able to verify, that there's been more investment in Ireland in the 90s than from America than there was in the entire American investment in China and India. Which seems to me like unbelievable, but there was an enormous amount. I mean, Intel and Microsoft and all those tech companies just headed there. And I guess they imported their Bay Valley, San Francisco Bay values as well, and couldn't help but rub off on the local population. Is that fair? Do you think or not?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think like everybody, we are dual citizens, especially in the West, of one foot in America and what's going on there with their massive, gargantuan cultural output, and the significance that their politics has for the rest of the world. And so I think that part of it is as you're describing, this proliferation of American commerce and what follows that in tow is are things like ESG, corporate social responsibility, diversity and quotas, etc. But I also think that they just they would just be inhaling a lot of American culture, as we all are, and they were very much in the market for a new set of values. So Mary Robinson was a president in Ireland, and she was Harvard educated in law, and she very much brought the values that she learned in America, in Ivy League America, back with her to Ireland. And she was one of the great progressive campaigners, and so I think that there's in a way there's a I think an insecurity in Ireland, like there is in many small countries, that they can't really sail their own ship, that they need to look to something bigger, whether that be in Brussels or the values and on the western the western seaboard of America.
Yeah. But there is disgruntlement at the moment about the current situation in Ireland, right? What has been the political response to the protests and to the criticism that's increasingly being voiced about the numbers that have been let in?
So there's really been there's been a great sort of oscillation between any protests are illegitimate and far right and motivated by racial prejudice or bigotry of some other variety, and then the government will sort of hit a wall either electorally or a protest will just start creating much embarrassment for them, and then they will row back. There's very rarely a mea culpa of the kind of like, we got this wrong. It's more that what is far right yesterday will become a government talking point or policy the next day. And it's just sort of like it's an irony that the most demonized people in Ireland are, you know, often doing its thinking for them, and then the government will just sort of plagiarize those points and act like nothing ever happened. And so they've on the whole been very unreceptive to the pushback they've been getting. Leo Varadkar, the former Taoiseach, famously said in response to one protest in a small town in Tipperary that no one has a veto over who moves into their area. And, you know, he was technically correct, because Ireland has, you know, in recent years quietly suspended all of the due diligence that you would need around planning and, you know, tendering for government contracts, because they've declared a kind of state of emergency in terms of immigration. And so, you know, whereas usually you might have some democratic recourse to say, actually, no thanks, I don't want my small village of 220 people to be swamped by 280 migrants. Now, no such recourse exists unless you either take your protest to the streets or you challenge the government in the courts, which some places don't have the funds or you know, the inclination to do.
Yeah, that's a phenomenon which I don't think exists in Australia, where a local hotel or a hostel, sometimes a very upmarket one, is commandeered essentially by the state, and the migrants are put in there. And sometimes, well, from what I read, it's often at an inflated rate, so the owner of the hotel is kind of happy about it, but completely changes the character of the town. And it also seems a bit unjust that you've got the locals who might go up there for Christmas dinner once in a while, would never dream or would not ordinarily stay in this place, are having to, I don't know, host these foreigners in a place which, you know, they couldn't afford themselves.
Yes, there's been many such examples in Ireland where, of course, the landlord or the hotel owner who's running a seasonal business, where, you know, they might have a full house 3 or 4 months a year, and they have to cover staff and overheads and all the rest of it, will snatch the government's arm off if they offer them a 2-year contract year round. You know, they can operate with a skeleton staff. Often they have their utilities and everything else covered. It's a great deal for them. Not so great for the community in a place like Rossgrave, for example, in Tipperary, where I've spent some time now, where town's only hotel is now gone. And so that's christenings, you know, funerals, old biddies playing bingo on a Sunday, that's all gone. So that community is left out to dry, and to add insult to injury, they've now got, you know, several hundred, if not, you know, near 1,000, migrants from parts of the world about which they know very little, about which they, you know, they have very little in common with these people. Many of them don't speak English, need translators, courtesy of the state. And they're disproportionately young males. Now, as one woman put it to me last year, she would be uncomfortable if there was a group of young Irish males loitering around in the center of a town with nothing to do, nowhere to go. When you add to that they're speaking in foreign tongues, it's very unpleasant for the town. It has this sort of slow, corrosive effect on what was a very tight-knit community.
Yeah, no, I saw that in the interview that you did for the documentary, I think you produced for The Telegraph, or at least part of it, in Rossgrave. And yeah, it was, the people interviewed were not neo-Nazi types. They were, you know, disgruntled locals who were, you know, with all the goodwill in the world, just upset that their town had been transformed. Is it correct to say there hasn't been in Ireland the equivalent of like a Reform or a Rassemblement National or, you know, Giorgia Meloni type of party that has been set up to tack, you know, in response to anti-immigration sentiment?
So there has been nothing resembling Reform or Le Pen in Ireland, because this issue really, I would say that there hasn't been a right-wing politics in Ireland really to speak of in the last 30 years. Obviously, Sinn Féin would have been the natural party of nationalists and even nativism in Ireland. But in the last few decades, they have sort of dropped the nationalist part of their offering, kept the socialist aspect. And so you will often find Mary Lou MacDonald, who's the leader of Sinn Féin, which in one translation, I think, means ourselves alone. Ironically, she's in mosques wearing a chador around her neck. She's saying, Ireland's Muslim community is essential for the country, and it's very sort of wishy-washy progressive multicultural party now that once was a very militarized nativist platform. And so the Irish people who have objected to immigration in recent years have been politically homeless. And there's been an upswell of small parties, the Irish Freedom Party and various other nationalist entities, which are not really serious. Their leaders are mired in infighting, and often one man in particular is prone to sort of dressing up as a Nazi. The nationalist the sort of nascent nationalist parties in Ireland performed very badly in last year's both local and national elections. And so I think the closest thing to a right-leaning populist party in Ireland would be Aintu, led by Paddy Tobin. But they're a relatively modest electoral force. They only have two members of parliament. If there is going to be some kind of populist nationalist revival in Ireland, we have yet to see it.
Where does Conor McGregor fit into this? Because he was at the White House recently. He had a high-profile podcast with Tucker Carlson, I think just over a week ago. And he's certainly making those types of noises about, wanting to, tackle the immigration amongst other things. But he doesn't have a party behind him. What's his plan?
Well, I think you might be doing a bit too much justice there, calling it a plan. I think it's more of an instinct with Conor McGregor, like it is with many people like him from working class areas. Like McGregor is from Crumlin in South Dublin, which would be, down at heel, fairly reviled by the what we call official Ireland. The people who really control the media and the government in the country. And it's people, like McGregor's, milieu from Crumlin that would be very skeptical of immigration and often have to bear the brunt of its worst effects, because they're in areas that are already ridden with crime and, poor public services, and they're having an influx now of what is effectively going to be another underclass of people who are living off the state, often creating increased waiting times for housing and putting pressure on hospitals and schools, and on top of that are being prioritized often above the native Irish. And so the McGregors of the world are very upset about that. And I think it's difficult to quantify really what effect, if any, McGregor is having. I think that he's certainly pally with Donald Trump. Donald Trump has this tendency, which we've seen with Nigel Farage, to almost like pick his own ambassador to a given country. Say, this is actually my guy in London or Dublin, and he's the guy I'm going to communicate. And so he's created these alternative pockets of access to Washington and American influence and power, of which McGregor seems to be his local MAGA appointed comprador in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a theme of his where he will greet the official president or prime minister of a particular country, but then he will, a week or so later, at least signal that he is sympathetic to the, you know, whoever's the leader of nationalistic sentiment in a particular country as well. So it's sort of playing both sides of the board. Do you think? Did you hung out with Conor McGregor and Tucker in Dublin, right? Is that right? Did I read a story saying you were at the same?
Conor McGregor sent out a tweet inviting people down for a drink after his interview with Tucker Carlson, and so I went along for the Telegraph to write about what shaped up to be quite an odd evening with cast of colourful characters. McGregor seems to be aiming his message at the Irish diaspora in America, which is 40 million strong. And I think it's almost reminiscent of the Troubles when, a large part of the Republican activity in Ireland was bankrolled by those, Bostonians often with shamrock tattoos who are more Irish than the Irish. I think that they're trying to get the cavalry to, as it were, to come over from the hill in America. And I think that was what the Tucker Carlson interview was designed to do. I think that's what McGregor's appearance in the White House was designed to do, is to raise the alarm among the Irish in America to, as he put it to me, let them know that the country where they hail from, where their ancestors hail from, is soon to be no more. This is a message that is completely rejected by the Irish establishment as misinformation and all the rest of it. However, in some places it's as unpleasant a character as McGregor is in his personal life and much more, there is something to be said for that. There is a community in County Tipperary, a small village called Dundrum, with a population of 220 people, which is now bracing itself for the arrival of more than 270 asylum seekers. So that's the complete effacement of the people and the culture in that area. And I think it's often lost in debates about population sizes and all the rest of it that mass immigration is primarily felt on the local level. It doesn't necessarily matter that you're still a majority in countrywide. If you're now a minority in your village, that's your whole world turned upside down. And that's one of the points that McGregor made in the White House, that communities have been overrun in one swoop. We are certainly seeing that in village and towns across the country. There's another place called Lisdoonvarna, which a few years ago was outnumbered by Ukrainian refugees. So I think that many people resonate with some of the points that McGregor's making, even though he might not be a particularly popular person with many Irish people for what are obvious reasons.
Yeah, I actually don't know the full background. I only know him from a distance, but I mean, I've heard different, things, but who knows? I mean,
it's probably important to signpost that he was recently found civilly liable for rape. And he, you know, he's got a list of convictions as long as your arm for many traffic offences, I think. But he also, you know, punched a pensioner in a pub a few years ago for rejecting a drink. And so, you know, many Irish people would see McGregor as a thug. And so he's a problematic prophet, as it were, or you know, a spokesperson for what are, you know, ultimately legitimate grievances of the Irish people.
How does it play out then? Are they not sort of more thoughtful, intellectual types in Ireland that also recognise the problem and can explain it in a way that's more palatable, I don't know, to the public broadcaster audience, in a way that Conor McGregor can't? I mean, isn't there, you know, because that's what you want, right? You want this to be all sort of corrected through reasonable talk rather than through riots or whatever on the streets. Is that not happening in Ireland?
I think that the, you know, what's called sometimes called the Overton window has shifted. Was unacceptable to say at one point, you know, a list of very bland observations that are, you know, fairly obvious, that, you know, mass migration will exert pressure on housing supply, that it will create a sense of social dislocation, that, you know, there are problems with crime and much else when you import people from very unstable regions. This is all sort of creeping now into the mainstream, where it was once beyond the pale to say it, and now you have some more mainstream politicians saying it. And I think the government have realized that you know, that the trajectory that they were on is untenable. While they did you know, while the centre roughly held at the last election, they did get a bloody nose in various ways. The Green Party, that was part of a three-party coalition in the last government, was roundly blamed for a lot of the failings of immigration, and they were completely wiped out. Other mainstream parties either remained stagnant or lost vote share. And so I think that the you know, the establishment is now coming out with utterances that they would have once roundly criticized. You know, the new justice minister, Jim O'Callaghan, has said that, you know, we need to ramp up deportations, that most of these migrants are actually economic migrants, not asylum seekers. And so there is some shift in the tone of the public debate. Unfortunately, there just aren't enough people who are, like you say, you know, credible and you know, have the know-how to turn that into a political capital.
Yeah, because it's not just the figment of people's imagination. There are serious and unprecedented demographic changes occurring in little old Ireland. I think one tidbit, either you or someone else mentioned that in Galway, which is a very pretty little town, I remember visiting ages ago, and where my family hail from, the most popular boy's name is Mohammed in that town. Now, that's sort of something that would have been beyond the imagination of, the, you know, Patrick Pearce and the boys when they hit the GPO back in the day, right? I mean, that's not the island that they were contemplating building. So at some point, you know, there have been revolutions in Ireland, political revolutions in the past in Ireland, you know, the Home Rule Party getting booted out and Sinn Féin taking over. Do you think at some stage it's just, there will be the natural antibodies of the place will sort of kick in and there will be some more dramatic change?
I'm not very optimistic that there will be a dramatic sort of political realignment in Ireland. I think that the Irish are in many ways, you know, quite reluctant to rock the boat. They just want to muddle on, and, you know, there's not a lot of scope to be an eccentric or to be a heretic in Ireland. And I, you know, we could try and work out the psychology of that. So I think it's probably a residue of the Catholic culture, and, you know, they have a very They have a great sporting culture where it's, you know, there's an emphasis on being a team player. And I think because it's in some ways got that small town mentality that the people who are often the Cassandras on issues like this are, you know, tend to be quite problematic characters like McGregor, who have a slightly antisocial or disagreeable, way about them, and that will put off many Irish people. And so I think if there is to be a massive political reckoning, it will probably swing in the direction of Sinn Féin, who, according to recent polls, are now polling at around 25%, which I think is greater than the other two main parties of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And, you know, that comes with its own issues for Ireland. It's, they're a socialist party. They have links to the former IRA. They're an outgrowth, or they were historically the political arm of that organization. And so they would be quite sympathetic to a lot of the armed violence and, often murder that organization committed in pursuit of its political aims. So I think that the alternatives for Ireland at the moment are very slim, and they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place of, do we go with the status quo, which clearly isn't working, or do we take the radical option of getting into, potentially supping with a greater devil in Sinn Féin?
I mean, the irony of all this is that even in Northern Ireland, the demographic change is happening so quickly that the old sectarian divide is sort of being diluted through massive migration. So are you familiar with how that's playing out, or how that's changing the politics of Northern Ireland?
Well, as one person strikingly put it to me in McGregor's pub the other night, all of the people in this pub have more in common with the loyalists up north than they do with, their own government. And so there is a sense of, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that the greater existential peril for Irish culture and its people is the mass migration of people from the far-flung regions of the world that many feel are being imposed on them. So I think there is that diluting effect, certainly among the people who feel strongest about this issue.
I saw some footage, I don't know how representative it is, with some Sinn Féin types and some, unionist types in the north holding hands and anti-mass immigration protest. I mean, that was something that wouldn't have happened 30 years ago.
Well, I can actually let you in on the sort of background of that story, where the I think it was the people from the Coolock Says No campaign, which is a Dublin suburb that was facing the arrival of 1,000 or 500 to 1,000 migrants in a local factory. Mm-hmm. And some of the people involved in that campaign took the banner and went up to the north and were seen, as you say, alongside loyalists and various other people. And when they, I was told by one campaigner that they weren't necessarily the brightest bulbs in the chandelier. And when they got back, there was some stern words exchanged. And so, we're not quite at the roasting marshmallows and singing Kumbaya stage just yet with a lot of people. Yeah.
It made for some great photos for the newspaper, I think, and some great footage on TV.
But
you play for them. Moving across back to the UK, there recently, I think a week and a bit ago, a French intellectual called Renaud Camus, who is famous for coining the term the Great Replacement, was banned from entering the UK. What's the current status of that case, and what was the real justification for that?
Well, the Home Office gave the reason that he wouldn't be conducive to the public good, as defined by them. And he is now appealing the ban. Interestingly, it seems to have backfired quite spectacularly, because he was due to give a talk at a conference with a fairly obscure nativist party here in the UK called the Homeland Party. And
I think one of the guys from Homeland, so I know I'm familiar with them.
They're by no means mainstream at all. And as a result of the ban, he's now plastered over the pages of our broadsheet newspapers and our television screens. And so it's had a sort of Barbara Streisand effect, where, you know, something that starts off small is becomes much larger as a result of your response to it. I think that, it reminds me of in the late 2000s when Geert Wilders was banned from entering the UK. This is the Dutch right-wing anti-Islam politician. Mm. And now Mr. Wilders' party is the one of the largest in the Netherlands, and actually in the government. It was able to form a government which many years ago, you know, back in the heady days of Tony Blair and Oasis, people would have thought impossible. So it's these things, these ideas, if they're suppressed, will find an outlet democratically through other means. And I think in the age of uncensored social media and the internet, there's very little point in banning somebody from a country if you're trying to suppress their ideas, apart from the obvious reason as well that, you know, it's a deeply illiberal thing to do. I think that in the debates around free speech, what's often lost is you're not just suppressing that person's right to speak, but also your own right to hear and listen to what they have to say. The government have done a disservice to not only Mr. Camus, who should have been allowed into the country, of course, but the people who want to listen to what he has to say, regardless of whether you agree with him or not.
And I don't think he has any background of any kind of political violence. He's not a Yasser Arafat character. He's, I think, fettered in many of the very esteemed intellectual circles in France, right? He's mild-mannered academic. It sort of seems particularly odd to be banning someone like that from coming into the country.
Yes, Dan. I think I make no claim to be a scholar of Camus' work, but from what I can tell, he's anti-violence. He has some quite forceful and interesting views about the long-term effects of mass immigration in Europe, which I think invite robust debate. And it's interesting as well that he's this fairly mild-mannered gay intellectual. Where there was a story out the other day that Douglas Murray, who is another immigration skeptic, also gay, has his books removed from the shelves of or not stocked on the shelves of one of Berlin's largest bookstores. And I think that it's interesting that the people who are raising the alarm about some of the negative effects of mass immigration tend to be from other minority groups. In Berlin recently, last year, gays and Jews were told not to be conspicuously Jewish or gay on the street because of an influx of arrivals that the country has absorbed in recent years that aren't very amenable to those minority groups. And so it's by putting one group on a pedestal, whether that be Islamists or whoever else, you often create a rod for the backs of other minorities.
Yeah, and they're the canaries in the coal mine, and they sense the change in the atmosphere before others often do. Just to finish up on a broader question, I mean, the demographic changes in Europe over the last 50 years have been unprecedented almost in its history, certainly within the last 1,000 years. What do you think future historians will say? How do you think they'll describe this period? And how do you think it ends? I mean, how do you think it kind of, how do you think the story plays out over the next 10, 20 years?
Well, just to take, one example, the Muslim population of Europe is now stands at 26 million, which is roughly 5% of the European Union's population. It's on track by 2050 to hit 75 million, which would then bring it, and the European Union's population is due to remain fairly stagnant, if not shrink, over that period, which would then bring it to around 15%. Like I say, this has felt very disproportionately. We've already seen in recent weeks in Vienna, the majority of primary school pupils are now Muslim. And so we are going to see the European continent start to resemble more and more, as we have in recent decades, the countries in which these people are fleeing from often. And I think that's no good thing, because if you look how people vote with their feet, the Muslims who have come from the Middle East and North Africa have come for a reason. And it ought to recreate the countries which are mired in dysfunction in which they fled from. And so I think that we will look back on the last few decades in particular as, you know, the greatest self-inflicted wound that a country or a continent has inflicted on itself, especially in living memory. It's really quite unprecedented. The cultural effacement of European peoples by European peoples primarily. I think historians will struggle to find the root cause of why we did it to ourselves. There's lots of debate around whether it's because we've lost God, or we have post-colonial guilt, or we have guilt from the Second World War, and I'm sure all of these things are significant. But there's a sort of civilizational ennui where I think we've just exhausted ourselves, and do not believe in our own story, in our own future, really. And so we've just handed over the reins of our societies without a fight. So I think, yeah, it will be a rather grim history. I'm sure there will be twists and turns that are hard to see now that are causes for optimism and even more skepticism. So.
Well, it's one for a future Chinese gibbon to ride along, you know, lengthy tome about, I'm sure. Hey,
this peninsula on the Asian continent, this strange peninsula we called Europe.
That's right. You can be, I don't know, grimly jocular about it all. That's not great. Hey, I've really appreciated you making time, and I know there's a lot of other stuff, documentaries and writing that you've done. You can provide it after, and I'll drop it on the show notes. But briefly, for people listening, where do they go to find out more about you and your work?
So if you look up my Twitter, it's MichaelMurph_Y. You'll find I regularly post about my writings and the films I'm making. I have a Substack on that page that you can find there. I write for the Daily Telegraph, the National Post, among other magazines, and I also have a documentary platform called Outpost Studios on Substack, which you can find all sorts of podcasts and video essays and documentaries that I'm making there as well.
Great stuff. Well, appreciate your time again, Michael, and I'm sure people in Australia will find this fascinating. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dan.
See you, mate. Bye.